Hello and welcome to Worstwood Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. And this week, we are in the director's box, watching Worst Two-Footed Tackle FC line up for today's big game. And when we say director's box, I don't mean a beautiful glass and wood panel suite overlooking the halfway line. I mean a shoebox that once contained some loafers that Steven Spielberg returned for being a bit tight around the heel. The buffet is suitably lavish, featuring all manner of delicious nibbles, vol-au-vents, a paste of mushrooms spread on some gently inflated woodland creatures, spring rolls, a tasty pastry wrapped around some metal coils, prawn cocktails, and yes, that emphasis is correct, and a selection of wines and beers, including the new offering from our big alcohol sponsor. You've heard the slogan, probably the best lager in the world. Well, their slogan is probably a lager. And if we look out now, we can see the players finally running out onto the pitch. Yes, we insist they play on a petroleum resin. We find it enhances our natural non-passing game. Our new star signing is a Capricorn, and he's donning the captain's armband, water wings and stabilisers. And as the referee walks over to perform the coin toss, we hope that that coin we gave him is a big enough bribe to persuade him to throw the game our way. And as he lobs a partridge in our direction, alongside me is my co-chairman, the Roman to my Abramovich, the Malcolm to my Glazer, and the Sheikh to my man's it's Ben Vandeveld.
Hello.
You're right.
You were running at about 10 puns per minute there. That was astonishing.
Can you tell I wrote that in about 10 minutes before the show started?
Well, not really. I think that you slaved over it for a couple of hours.
I think that's my internal monologue just made external.
I feel like we've both got good football owner names.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if I heard that Leighton Orient were being bought out by the Vandeveld and McStay consortium.
Yeah.
I think that they were sort of like big in horse racing.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, some sort of
diamond, blood diamonds.
Yeah.
Like Hicks and Gillette, when they came to Liverpool, they didn't sound convincing enough. Like the Gillette bit I buy, but someone called Hicks, you're like, yeah, what's your deal?
Yeah, Hicks sounds sort of like a 1920s prohibitionist, like booze runner.
Yes, hang out with John Dillinger.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you been in like any like expensive director's suites or things at football matches?
I've been in the Platinum Club at Newcastle United.
Oh, nice. What's that like?
It's the poshest seats we've got.
Everyone drinks from Crystal Sports Direct mugs.
Yeah, I've not been in there since Ashley took over.
Okay, fine.
It was, essentially, I went there in like the late 90s when the seats were slightly better upholstered.
Nice.
And the beer wasn't warm.
Who's our guest this week?
We should introduce our guest.
I just left them sitting at the other end of a Skype call.
Sorry, mate, I was having a lovely chat. Our guest this week is, according to the BBC at least, an online joker. In October 2018, he hit the headlines by leading an ultimately unsuccessful campaign to have England defender Harry Maguire riding on an inflatable unicorn as the new face of the £50 note. A campaign backed by more than 50,000 signatories. But
who did he lose out to?
Captain Enigma.
Who?
The
Alan Turing.
Thank you,
Alan
Turing.
Sorry, I thought you mentioned it like a lesser-known Avenger.
No, yeah. Where he just turns up and goes, oh, quick, Captain, what's his real name? I don't know. Yes, and frankly, I'm glad that he didn't succeed after Harry Maguire's lamentable performance at the weekend. If anyone should be on the new £50 note, it should be little Matty Longstaff. By day, he can be found on Twitter mainly making jokes about, and at the expense of, his beloved Newcastle United, as well as football and the world more generally. He's also an ambassador for the men's mental health and suicide prevention charity Calm, and a football manager enthusiast, nay, fundamentalist.
That's the game rather than the people, right?
Yeah, bit of column A, bit of column B, I imagine. It is the ever sharp and always Johnny Sharples.
Hello, quite the introduction. I don't quite know what ever Johnny means, but I'll take it.
Ever Johnny is a reusable condom.
Okay. We were all thinking it.
Yes, we were. I'm so sorry.
Just a quick question. Why an inflatable unicorn for Harry Maguire? Why not an actual unicorn?
Because there was some images from the 2018 World Cup where they were doing a team bonding session and having races in the swimming pool or riding inflatable unicorns.
Amazing.
So it was like for all the iconic images from England at World Cups, where you have like Michael Owen's goal against Argentina in 1998, you have Gazza in tears at the end of, you know, Italia 90. For Russia 2018, we have Harry Maguire riding an inflatable unicorn in a swimming pool.
I feel like after Brexit, Gazza in Tears would be more appropriate on our currency.
Gazza in Tears sounds like a good band name.
Yeah.
As well.
Or at least it sounds more like an Ultravox single or something. Yeah. Very 80s.
How do you become an online joker? What university course did you do?
I went to Preston University and did criminology, which is good standing to be an online joker. not a proper university, not a proper course, many would say. The BBC, it was after the inflatable unicorn thing, and in an article they called me an online joker, but they spelt my name wrong, so Johnny doesn't have a H in it, so I corrected them, and then they removed the online joker bit as well, so then I asked them to put that back in, and they were kind enough to put online joker back into the article and amend the spelling of my name.
That's an awkward conversation to have, isn't it? Like, you know that bit where you said that I'm funny, but you took it out? Could you pop back in that I am officially funny, according to the BBC?
I've had some business cards printed.
Yeah. I've already sent the screenshot round to my mum. You're going to have to put it back in. Yeah. So she doesn't think I'm fake.
I did that recently. I had a Twitter conversation with Annika Rice, and for the proudest moment of my life, I had to screenshot it and send it to my husband.
That's beautiful. I feel like if we ever get business cards made for this podcast, then screenshotted business cards would be the appropriate thing.
From like the most insulting tweet we've ever received from somebody.
It'd be about Daphne and Celeste.
Yeah, it'll definitely be about Daphne and Celeste.
Your Twitter account is one of the few happy places left on Twitter.
I don't know about that.
But I have genuine admiration for your ability to pull literally any subject around to either Championship Manager 97-98.
The best version of Championship Manager.
Yeah. Or Kevin Keegan's Entertainers. You can refer any topic to that. It's beautiful.
I think it's beautiful or worrying. Yeah. It's just the ability to do it. But I think they're just two things that I absolutely love. And so just any excuse to bring them back into the public attention wherever and whenever possible is just a dream come true.
Who was your favourite player from the Entertainers?
So this is the Newcastle team of the mid-90s, right?
Yeah, the one that almost but didn't quite win the title.
Fine.
I'm looking at my laptop right now and Philippe Albert is the background on my laptop.
on brand.
So I have to say Philippe Albert as well, just because he embodied, he was a defender that scored stupendous goals, so he sort of represented everything of the Entertainers era.
Absolutely delightful. For non-football fans or for our American or listeners, he was a sturdy 6'3" Belgian man with a moustache that looked like he was a stand-in for Magnum PI who retired to become a burly greengrocer. What is there not to love about the man?
Did you have a go-to number one signing you'd always try and buy when you played Football Manager as well, Championship Manager? People were obsessed with signing Jan Vennegut of Hesselink in the version that was being played when I was in school. Him and Kim Kellstrom were the two like wonder things in the sort of the early noughties that people say, yeah, these are the guys, they're like the hack.
I mean, Jan Vennegut of Hesselink sounds like he's wandered into the world of football from medieval jousting.
Yeah. That was his downfall. It's quite hard to run with a lance.
Yeah.
Certainly to dribble.
Yeah.
The first football match I ever went to was Preston North End against Darlington in the auto windscreen shield. And Sean Gregan, who was Preston's captain, got sent off in that match. And I absolutely loved him from that point on and would either sign him or call him up for England, no matter when and where he was playing. So he would become a staple of every team I played, no matter how good or bad, more often than not, he was.
You've got to find a rock upon which to build your church.
It's something. It's a bit like being like a ghost of Christmas past, present, and future with Scrooge. You get to like change the path of these people's lives, like jumping, going. You're suddenly playing for England now. Like, what? This isn't in my future. Like, yes, but I've made it possible.
Yeah, when you're England manager in that game, you're like the giant golden finger in the National Lottery adverts. Yeah. I choose
it's
you.
Like when Mike Bassett in the film accidentally calls up two players because is it Lambert and Butler because he's written the team on the back of a bag packet.
Yeah.
So he accidentally calls them up. It's a bit like that, but almost more real than the fictional film.
We always ask our guest, Johnny, what they're worst at in the world. Obviously, you're very good at being an online joker and insisting that you are an online joker. What would you say you're worst at?
I think it's one of those things where you never know you're bad at something until you absolutely have to do it. And I moved into a new house and there's lots of DIY to do. And I am very bad at DIY. To put it into perspective, my girlfriend had quite a bad car accident 4 years ago, broke her back. And she's been left to do a lot of the DIY in our house. That's how poor I am. Somebody that cracks some vertebrae is miles better at it than I could ever dream to be.
We've got a lovely view of your spare room behind you as we were recording on Skype, and there's some lovely shelves that are a little sort of shelf unit behind you. Was that your doing or hers?
Hers. There's a mirror in front of me, her doing. I've got the laptop balanced on a bed that I'd like to say we built as a collective, but I think she definitely took the lead in it.
I feel the same way. I very much outsource any manual labour to my wife.
Who then outsources it to other people.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think I carry the same role as you, Johnny. When it comes to anything practical, I am at best a cheerleader.
I'm quite good at reading the instructions, which is so I'll sit back and read them out loud, and then they can be ignored or listened to at will.
But with IKEA instructions, though, if you're able to read, that's like being the Rosetta Stone, basically.
Yeah. I was going to say, I do that as well, but when I get onto the instructions in Finnish, my wife tends to get quite bored by then.
We've moved house this year, my husband and I, and we ordered like a shelving unit for the hallway. And it arrived while he wasn't in the house. And so I sort of sent him a picture of the box and said, I'm going to make it and it'll be ready when he comes home. And he's like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah, no, I can do it. He's like, I will be home in just over an hour. I said, no, it's fine. I'm getting a subtext. You don't want me to do this. I did it and I got it into position. And he came home about 10 minutes after I'd finished. I'd tidied everything away. And he came in. I was like, look. And he's like, oh, it looks great. And the first thing he did was he put a hand on a corner and just gently rocked it just to see.
That's the confidence that all marriages are built on. Yeah.
We're going to mine your knowledge of the sporting world as we take on the worst sports club owner. Mm-hmm. You had originally suggested football. We've expanded it to other sports as well. And Ben is going to kick us off with a big hitter right out the gate.
Damn right I am. We are going to commence by going to that hotbed of footballing brilliance, Libya.
Which we recently learned doesn't have a rail network.
Yes, that's true, which means it's very difficult for away days for supporters.
Yeah.
Colonel Gaddafi, his son al-Saadi, was the president of the entire Libyan Football Federation. And you know what it is, it's a classic bureaucrat jobs for the boys thing. But over here, if you're the head of the FA, you tend to sort of stay out of the playing and the running, not al-Saadi.
Oh, that's I wish Prince William, though, would, like, insist he gets to tog out for England every now and again.
I think Prince William's actually quite a good footballer as well.
I imagine he probably is.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you have decent physical fitness, having served in the army,
no one's
going to tackle him.
Yeah. Say anything different and you might be done for treason. So.
Yeah.
I thoroughly support the notion that he's a very good footballer.
Yeah.
As a staunch Republican, I bet he's, like, a Titus Bramble figure.
I imagine he'd be really good on the wing, just in a sedan chair being taken up and down by two butlers. And then obviously they substitute on the Lamberts.
He has a literal 12th man.
Yeah. Like that, whatever you might suffer at the hands of Prince William, nothing to what you'd suffer at the hands of al-Saadi. First of all, rigged the league in his own favour, forcing all the best players to join his team, as well as bribing all the referees, which sort of takes the fun out of it.
Was this a team he was playing for, a team he owned?
It's a team he both played for and owned.
Of course.
So, there's a lot of that, I think, in the rest of this podcast.
Yeah. Just assume by this point, listeners, that if we don't say otherwise, the person we're talking about owns the club, plays for the club, and is probably using the club to sort of, like, whitewash their money.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it always seems to be, like, football, soccer club owners. Like, when you get to America, I'd love to see, like, a wealthy 80-year-old billionaire insist he gets to play for the Miami Dolphins.
Yeah. God, yeah, going out on the Zimmer frame.
Yeah.
Oh, no, but playing as like a wide receiver on a little...
A little moped.
A little
mobility scooter.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Or you get, like, if they're like a tiny, like a Mr. Burns type figure, you just give them the ball, give them carrying the ball to the quarterback, and the quarterback flings them into the end zone.
Brilliant. The only thing is, though, is that if you were flinging a 80-year-old billionaire across a football pitch, then the end zone would have a very different meaning. Anyway, back to Colonel Gaddafi's proudest son. As you can imagine, some teams didn't want to play as teams. So one time, a team went, we're not going to play because you cheat all the time and the referees are on your pay. So Gaddafi went, Sure you are. Some soldiers came down and pointed their guns at the opposing team and said, get on that pitch and play.
Wow.
As a final insult to injury, after the game, Al-Sadi had their clubhouse bulldozed to the ground. But my favourite baller move from him is that he banned, across the league, announcers mentioning any name of any player other than himself.
Fucking hell, that makes commentary difficult.
Yes, yeah, it really does.
So silence for 12 minutes and then Al-Sadi on the ball. And then 10 more minutes of silence.
Bloody good rep.
Yeah. But he didn't have his talents confined just to the Libyan league.
Oh, did these go to Italy?
He got a big money move to Perugia. Oh. And the big money was being kicked back from Perugia to Libya.
Oh, fuck.
He played in 3 seasons a total of 26 minutes because he wasn't a footballer. He was a dictator's son. And he was eventually kicked out of Italy. And just imagine how much of a shithead you have to be kicked out of the Italian league.
Yeah.
when he ended up failing a drugs test.
That's what they got him for.
Yeah.
That's like Al Capone getting done for his taxes.
Yeah.
That's so disappointing.
My favourite thing about that is his father wasn't really into football. At one point...
You say this was all one big cry for help.
It might have been.
Just wanted daddy to love him.
So, Gaddafi actually opened a football tournament with the inspiring words, all you stupid spectators, have your stupid game. So he was quite dumbing. I wouldn't quite classify him as a sports club owner, but a sports event owner. I looked at Nero. Emperor Nero.
That's friend of the show, Emperor Nero.
Yeah.
If you're listening.
Yeah. So in the first century AD, he managed to win 1,808 Olympic medals.
Oh, fuck off.
by basically, what's the word I'm looking for?
Inventing an Olympic Games that wasn't taking place at the time.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And then also doctoring every event so that he won it. So first of all, he ordered the entire Olympics to be postponed for 2 years to coincide with his visit of Greece. My favourite thing he did is chariot racing. All chariot racers have only 4 horses. Not old Emperor Nero.
Per chariot.
Per chariot, yeah. He had 10 horses.
How do you even choreograph that? That's
okay. Yeah. Well, I'd like to hope that the 10 horses were disguised as 4 horses somehow. So that
the front end of one horse was 2 horses.
Yeah, exactly.
Put them inside one Trojan horse.
Yeah.
and just...
everyone looking at it's going, well, that's clearly cheating.
Yeah, but it's going to be... Do you want to believe what your eyes and ears are telling you, okay, or do you want to keep your head?
The Emperor's new horses.
Correct. Oh, no, the horses were fully clothed. Just to make sure as well, he did also bribe all the other riders to drop out.
That shows a lack of confidence.
But brilliantly...
In your 10 horses.
Yeah.
Brilliantly, he actually fell during the race and was unable to finish.
Trampled by 10 horses.
But was still declared the winner.
Oh, no.
This sounds like something from Life of Brian.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? You know, it's something like the really early modern Olympics. There were things like poetry reading. But Nero invented a variety of different musical competitions he could compete in. He was a terrible musician. His performances were apparently so bad that people would literally pretend to be dead so he would stop. but he still won. And then when he won, he ordered the statues of all previous winners to be torn down and hurled into the public toilets.
I'd give it about 10 minutes.
Yeah. I'd just be glad that Donald Trump doesn't fancy himself as an Olympian, is all I'm saying.
You fucking bet he does.
Yeah.
We've all seen him go wrestling. I mean, that's a guy with... I mean, his latest thing about he's got unmatched wisdom. He's gone full Ming the Merciless.
Since we briefly talked about America, let's go to America. I think you guys might have some more stuff on that. But it is staggering the number of old, white, obviously Republican men who are focused on ruining all that is good and great about American sporting traditions. The worst one I could find was a chap called Bill Wirtz, who owned the Chicago Blackhawks for, gosh, going on almost 40 years. They didn't win a single championship when he was owner. And in 2007, when there was a game honouring him after his death, the Black Hawks fans booed his name.
Wow.
Yeah. He also said that he wouldn't allow any home games to be televised because it was unfair to people who bought tickets. I'll tell you about one other American sports team owner. The owner of the Kansas City A's, now known as the Oakland A's, a chap called Charlie Finley. And when they're a baseball team, when they won a second World Series, he gave them glass rings. Or O's, because he said not enough players thanked him for his contribution.
Because they usually get like proper metal rings when they win things, don't they?
Yeah.
The World Series, yeah.
He also had weird promotions that he liked to have run during the game, including having a mechanical rabbit hand umpire's new baseballs.
Being chased by a mechanical greyhound.
I love that was the case.
Yeah.
At various points, he employed his wife in high-end administrative roles, and as well as his wife, he employed MC Hammer.
In a high-end administrative role?
I don't know. That's all I know. I'm going to go back to England for my next suggestion. Johnny, you might know who this guy is. George Reynolds.
Darlington, he's... Yeah.
George Reynolds was a lifelong criminal with convictions for burglary, safe-cracking and theft dating back to the 60s. My dad actually had to do business with him in the 90s.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, not cool.
When you say business, did he have a safe that needed cracking?
Dad couldn't get into the Vanderveld family safe, and George came down, got out a little crowbar and sorted it.
He owned what club?
He owned Darlington, because having gone to jail in the 70s, a priest persuaded him to reform, apparently, and he started a series of businesses, including a kitchen servicing factory, and by the early 2000s, he had amassed a fortune of £260 million. So he became the chairman of Darlington Football Club, immediately built him a stadium costing 20 million quid, which he named after himself.
Yeah.
Of course he did. But within 4 years, he took the club into administration, just months after opening this new stadium, which was a 25,000-seater, one of the biggest outside the Premier League.
Ah.
The stadium was very swiftly renamed, but it's become somewhat of a white elephant, because Darlington have fallen through the league system like a hot ball bearing through butter.
Yeah.
They were relegated from the league system in 2010, they were then relegated 4 further divisions.
Oh, wow.
To the Northern Football League, and have since had to be reformed as a new club, Darlington 1883, which is owned by the fans.
It's 1883, the number of Darlington fans left.
Yes.
My favourite stat about the Reynolds Arena, now the Darlington Arena, is the biggest ever attendance at the stadium is 17,000. Which was for an Elton John concert.
Amazing.
Is it seated or is it just still standing?
Oh,
that is too good. That is too good. Just, you know, listeners, Johnny has disappeared from shot on our Skype interview because he couldn't bear to look at what Barry had just done.
It's a very enjoyable joke.
I've got 2 more nutters to tell you about before my suggestion. First of all, a chap called Maurizio Zamperini in Palermo, who was a proper sort of, like, angry Italian gangland chap. I've just got one word, one quote to tell you from him. He says, "If my players keep being shit, I will cut off their testicles and eat them in my salad." His version of a Caesar salad sounds awful.
Wow.
Oh, God, imagine what a Nero salad would be like. It would just be leaves with the waiter telling you how brilliant it is.
Yeah.
And more horse meat than a Findus. Yeah.
Another noted nutter, a guy called Jesus Gil, who owned Atletico Madrid, so a hefty force in Spanish football.
Jesus Gil.
He was, in the articles I read, was referred to as like a Spanish Trump. Before he was a football club owner, he famously and quite depressingly built an apartment building with no decent checks on it, and it collapsed, killing 58 people.
Yes.
And he somehow did not go to jail. He was quite the bon vivant. He apparently shared a house with 19 prostitutes at one point, including a mate of his who was a priest.
Oh, wow.
He employed 39 managers in 16 years at Atletico, including, and I didn't realise this, former Man United manager and noted on-air racist Big Ron Atkinson, who lasted 93 days before being fired.
Which probably made him like their longest-serving manager in that period.
Yeah, and he was so hated, there was a band who I'm going to say they're a metal band because they're called Prolapse. And in 1994, they released a song called Surreal Madrid, all about him.
Wowee.
So yeah, he was unsurprisingly a racist and a homophobe. He was disqualified by UEFA for referring to a referee as a homosexual. And when he appeared on a late night Spanish TV show, presumably to talk about his role as the owner of Atletico Madrid, he made sure he appeared in a jacuzzi surrounded by 10 scantily clad women. But from a football point of view, there's one other awful thing that he did. He disbanded the Atletico youth team. Now, you'll remember, Johnny, when Kevin Keegan took over, he disbanded our reserve team because there was no point in it, according to him, and it ruined the St. James's pitch. And I love King Kev, but that was a real error. Yeah. Not as bad as this one. He disbanded the Atletico Madrid youth team that had in it, at its time, a young man called Raul. Yeah. who went on to become the greatest striker in Real Madrid's history.
Wow.
So yeah, a pretty...
Has an eye for a winner.
Yeah, he really does. But my suggestion is not going to be him, as bad a person as he is. My suggestion is going to be all 53,000 people who registered to take over Ebbsfield United Football Club in 2007.
53,000?
Yeah.
Did they, like, want a fan ownership thing? Was that what was going on?
Sort of. So in November 2007, they were taken over by an internet-based firm called My Football Club. All one word. And by paying £35 a share, they could then vote online for how that football club was run, essentially creating real-life championship manager.
Oh, no, that's a terrible idea. Yeah.
So at first it went quite well. 53,000 people registered interest in it, and eventually 23,000 stumped up the annual fee. So within a month of accepting investors, they generated over £500,000. This was before it was announced that Ebbsfield United would be the actual football club. MyFC.com suggested that Leeds United, who are languishing in Division 1, might take part. Could be Nottingham Forest, could be Arsenal. But in the end, no, it was Ebbsfield United, which, I have to say, some investors were quite angry about. But in their first season, they won the FA Trophy, which is the knockout competition for non-league clubs.
That's good.
And they picked up a second trophy, beating Cray Wanderers 4-0 in the Kent Senior Cup. However, they finished in 11th place in the table, and pretty soon donors lost interest. In the summer break, they got their first chance to actually buy new talent. Bristol City put in a bid to buy one of their players, John Akinde, and 82% of them said, yes, let us sell him, which must have been a bit brutal for poor John.
Wow, going, yeah.
four out of five club members want me gone.
That's no Brexit referendum result, though. That's a very clear mandate.
Then the members clubbed together to secure the signature of a player for £20,000. Now, I'm not going to say nominative determinism is always a thing in football, but they bought from Cambridge City a player called Michael Gash. in October 2010, the MyFC fans took away Liam Dyche, the manager's control of all transfer dealings. So any proposed signing or sale had to be discussed with the membership 48 hours in advance, which basically tied the hands of the club chairman, the club secretary, and the manager. The man who created My Football Club, Brooks, whose brainchild it was, basically parted company with the project. The manager and the squad did the best they could, but they were very quickly running out of money because the number of people who were paying subscription was falling quickly every single month.
Wow.
So by the end of 2010, there was only 3,500 members, and they had to try and raise the fee to £50, which no one's going to pay. So by the end of 2011, they had to raise £50,000 or they would have gone out of business. And in the end, the My Football Club experiment failed and they were bought out by a Kuwaiti subsidiary company headed by Peter Varney, who was the man who broke Charlton Athletic. They were bought for £10,000.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, it's a pretty sad story. So it turns out using a Kickstarter to run a football club. Not a good idea.
No. 23,000 people at the same. That is one hectic conference call.
Yeah.
That's a big WhatsApp group.
It yeah. really is, yeah. yeah.
And then, but like 5 minutes in, people are swapping GIFs and like doing puns about cheese. It's gone off like the rails immediately.
It's basically a football club as run by the city-state of Athens.
Yeah. yes.
I couldn't live with myself if I didn't at least give a mention to Mike Ashley.
Yeah, and for listeners at home who saw the title of this episode, stop the clock.
although, in comparison to a lot of the people, not that bad. He renamed the stadium to the Sports Direct Arena completely without any payment from his own business.
For people who aren't regular listeners, this is the owner of Ben's beloved Newcastle United and indeed Johnny's Newcastle United.
Yeah.
In 2012, gave an 8-year contract to Alan Pardew, who left the club in January 2015, and therefore his contract is still due to run out until June 2020.
What was the payout on that?
I think Crystal Palace bought him out of his contract, and thankfully Newcastle didn't have to put up any money towards it. In the litany of bad owners, Portsmouth have had quite a lot. The best one I found was Ali Al-Faraj, who probably didn't exist.
What?
Nobody could find any trace of him. Nobody in Saudi Arabia, where he was allegedly from, knew who he was, but apparently he bought a 90% stake in Portsmouth while they were still a Premier League side.
What?
Is this the same guy who tried to take over Newcastle United in the summer?
No, although he probably also does not exist.
What? Where did these like invented people come from? Is it attempts to like buff up the price for other potential bidders?
Well, no, I think they're inspired by later versions of Football Manager, where if you go long enough, then it just spawns new players.
Yeah, that's fair.
We touched on Perugia earlier with Al-Sayed Gaddafi, but Luciano Gauci, who is Perugia's owner, in 2002, when Italy were knocked out of the World Cup by South Korea, South Korea's golden goal was scored by Ahn Heung-kwan, who was with the Italian side Perugia. So Luciano Gauci attempted to sack him, saying that he had ruined Italian football. He only started to play well when South Korea were drawn against Italy, and Gauci would not pay any more of his salary.
Wow.
It transpired that Ahn was only on loan at Perugia, and Perugia had agreed quite a low deal to complete the move to permanent. When Gauci realised that his stock had increased following the World Cup, he then attempted to buy him after previously attempting to sack him. he also signed Colonel Gaddafi's son. You touched on the fact that he failed a drugs test, but what you didn't mention was that Gaddafi had hired Diego Maradona to be his technical consultant and 1988 drugs cheats from the Olympics, Ben Johnson as his personal trainer. So it wasn't that much of a surprise.
That's a hell of a party. Okay, and your dinner party, complete this group. You want Gaddafi's son, Maradona, Ben Johnson, who's your fourth?
Scarface.
Yeah. And Gauci also attempted to sign women's German international Brigitte Prinz and Swedish women's international Hanna Lundberg, because he discovered that there were technically no rules against signing women players in Serie A. Serie A blocked it, and then Gauci said he was going to try and sign a horse instead.
Hang on, is that the football signing equivalent of, well, if gay people are allowed to get married, then I'll marry my dog? So like if I can't sign women, then I'll sign some livestock instead. Yeah.
John Batchelor of York City. This is quite a long story before we even get to his football career, because
Excellent.
There's a lot to take in. In 1997, John Batchelor stood as a common sense sick of politicians candidate in the general election, coming in last place in Blackburn with 0.8% share of the vote, or 362 votes. In 1999, decided he was becoming a racing driver, with having previously owned a cleaning supplies company. He won the Super Road Saloons Championship and moved into the Ford Fiesta Z-Tec Championship, where he secured sponsorship from Top Gear on the basis that he changed his name to John Top Gear, with Top Gear double-barreled.
and then immediately got a call from the man in Perugia who wanted to sort out Gaddafi's son.
Yeah. In 2001, he entered the British Touring Car Championship and secured funding from B&Q. And, yep, you guessed it, he changed his name to John B&Q. And then the same year, he stood for election again, this time in Tatton, and again got 0.8% of the vote, but this time that was lessened to 322 votes. Then we get to his football career. In 2002, he became the owner of York City, allegedly in a £4.5 million deal. It later transpired that he'd only bought the club for a pound instead. In a bid to broaden the appeal of the Division Three side to the United States, he changed the name of the club to New York City Soccer Club.
That's amazing.
He then redesigned the crest and the kit to include a checkered flag pattern, because obviously he loved his motorsport.
Yeah.
The Supporters Trust bought the club back a year later when it entered administration and immediately changed back the name, the crest and the kit. But Batchelor didn't stop there. In 2008, he tried to launch a takeover of Mansfield Town with plans to change their name to Harchester United, which is the name of the fictional club in Sky One's Dream Team.
Oh my God.
It was unsuccessful.
This is like a real life episode of that. That's so good.
And then later on made a £1.5 million bid for Accrington Stanley, but with the intention of moving them to a 10,000 seater stadium in the greater Manchester town of Lee and changing their name to Lancashire United. That bid was also turned down.
That's bold. Just a wee footnote on Accrington Stanley, because I remember something I didn't talk about. Their owner got in trouble with the FA because instead of paying bonuses, he offered to take the players out for a McDonald's if they won. But basically what he'd do, if they won, then he would buy them a McDonald's. If they lost, they had to pay for it himself.
Cool. Nice guy.
Yeah, real nice guy. But he was breaking FA rules, because if that wasn't in their contract, then it wasn't allowed to be carried out.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, back to York City.
We moved on to Billericay Town, which is Glenn Tamplin, who bought non-league Billericay Town in December 2016 with the aim of taking them to the Premier League, even though they were in the seventh tier. Even though they were in the seventh tier, he managed to sign former Wolves, Portsmouth and Fulham midfielder Jamie O'Hara, who left Gillingham earlier in the year to appear on Celebrity Big Brother. He also signed former England international and a goal scorer in the 2006 FA Cup final, Paul Konchesky, and Jermaine Pennant, who was once Britain's most expensive teenager and played in the 2007 Champions League final.
Yeah.
He painted a mural of himself in bed outside the ground and painted lines on the walls of the dressing rooms in order to inspire the teams.
Oh, to make the room more slim.
Yeah. Appointed himself as manager before sacking himself after three straight defeats in February 2018. 2 days later, he appointed himself again. And then resigned as manager once more in April 2018, where he appointed someone called Harry Wheeler as manager.
I like the distinction between those two, where he sacked himself the first time round. The second time round, he had the good grace to resign before he made himself,
He appointed Harry Wheeler as manager. Wheeler was sacked in August 2018, despite winning the Isthmian Premier League, the Isthmian League Cup and the Essex Senior Cup as manager.
The classic domestic trouble.
Yeah.
Before Tamplin reappointed him 147 days later in January 2019. However, in September 2019, Wheeler was sacked once again after refusing to play Glenn Tamplin's 16-year-old son in any matches.
Oh my God.
2 days later, Tamplin stepped down as owner of the club, despite the fact that he still does technically co-own the club. That's an ongoing story. That could still be breaking as we're on air.
Yeah. He's probably reappointed himself as owner.
One more and then I'll get to my nominee. We're going to go with Peter Winkleman. In 1997, Peter Winkleman decided he wanted to create a large retail development in Milton Keynes, which included the proposal for a Football League stadium, despite the fact that Milton Keynes didn't have a Football League team. But that didn't stop him. He offered the site to Luton Town, Wimbledon, Barnet, Crystal Palace and Queen's Park Rangers. In 2001, Wimbledon decided to take Winkleman up on the offer and the move was approved by the Football Association. And then they moved to Milton Keynes in 2003, still under the name Wimbledon, despite the fact that they moved 60 miles away.
It's a real baller move. Of all the London clubs, one of the most southerly to move up to Milton Keynes.
Yeah.
In 2004, they changed their name to Milton Keynes Dons after protests from actual genuine Wimbledon fans, and the club went into administration in 2003, and the following year were bought out by a consortium led by Peter Winkleman, the owner of the large retail development that had coaxed Milton Keynes Dons there to begin with. However, fans of Wimbledon reformed as AFC Wimbledon in 2002 and started life down in the ninth tier of the football pyramid. They gained six promotions in 13 years, and last season was the first season that they played in the tier above Milton Keynes Dons for the first time.
Yeah, that's now, very satisfying.
There's such a, like, every now and again, because I'm a Liverpool fan, and I don't always look down the leagues, but every now and again you catch a glimpse of a lower league table, you see AFC Wimbledon, you think, go on lads, go on, I want to see you back in the Premiership.
You catch a glimpse.
This is very hard to see, they're so far below. Give me this one thing. We may never win one of these things. The past 8 weeks have been joyous.
Oh, gosh, I've just no idea how you feel, Barry.
I know, it's so hard just being the champions of Europe.
But my nominee is a man named Ken Richardson. Now, yes. Ken Richardson is an interesting man. He took over Doncaster Rovers in 1993, at which point he appointed himself, his daughter, and his niece to a three-person board of directors. So no conflict of interest there. He then tried to set about asset stripping Doncaster Rovers and put an advert in a local newspaper advertising that their Bellevue Stadium was for sale, which was brought to the attention of the local council, who actually owned Bellevue Stadium. And didn't know anything about it. But that didn't stop Ken Richardson in his dastardly and cunning plans. He had a history of cunning plans. In 1984, he switched two horses that he owned in a race in order to rip off bookmakers. So he's got quite a history.
We talked about that recently. It was my favourite thing about it was I read this story, and he swapped a two-year-old gelding for a three-year-old horse. And two-year-olds and three-year-old horses, there's like a considerable physical difference. So a three-year-old should have carried 47 pounds more than the equivalent two-year-old would have. So it won by 20 lengths, which is immediately suspicious. And it seems like he and the trainer had come up with this plan and didn't tell the jockey. So the jockey, a jockey who was in it, would have, like, you know, tried to slow the horse up a bit, make him not win by quite so much. Whereas the fact that this guy was like, I'm driving a supercar.
Probably how Sardi Gaddafi felt when he was with Ben Johnson.
Yeah. He was banned from racing for 25 years, apparently.
So his plan to get around the fact that the local council actually owned Doncaster Rovers Stadium, he hired a former member of the SAS to burn down the stadium as part of an insurance scam. Yeah. However, the man that he hired left his mobile phone at the scene, which the police then traced to a local gang of career criminals. And they also found that the telephone had left a message on Ken Richardson's answering machine, which said, "The job is done."
Yeah. That's incredible.
You can see why he's a former SAS guy. Yeah.
In 1999, Ken Richardson was sentenced 4 years in prison as part of this insurance fraud, but not before he appointed Mark Weaver as manager of Doncaster Rovers. Mark Weaver's previous experience had been as the manager of Stockport County, club shop, and half-time lottery. So that was Ken Richardson, the man that almost brought Doncaster Rovers to their knees. They've been back in the championship for quite a while now, so that's another, you know, where it's been turned around.
Yeah. I read, this guy Weaver he appointed, he'd been at the club shop in Stockport. He was basically, Richardson would send him messages and team talks that Weaver would have to do on his behalf. And he even became player manager himself at one point, Weaver.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Just a case of like, well, if you guys aren't going to sort this, I'll do it myself.
Yeah, pretty much.
I think they were down to like seven first team members or something. So Weaver, despite having no history in professional football, just appointed himself as one of the players as well.
They were trying to cut costs by like sacking their players or like cutting contracts. And they dropped out of the league in 1998 with a minus 83 goal difference. They had to borrow kits from Sheffield United to play in because they were so under-resourced.
My favourite thing with Richardson was when he was put on trial, his evidence was described by the prosecution as the worst concoction of waffle, piffle and flannel that they've ever heard. And it's just really lovely to hear that Boris Johnson worked as a QC before he became Prime Minister.
Yeah, detectives who picked him up said he was the type that would trample a two-year-old child to pick up a two-penny bit.
Oh, that's a proper Yorkshire put-down, isn't it?
I read about another English football club owner, Tony Wood, who used to own Leighton Orient. There's a very famous documentary called Orient Club for a Fiver that aired on Channel 4 in 1995. It sort of documented the 94-95 season at Brisbane Road, where Orient play. They were losing 10 grand a week in money. Their squad only had 13 players left in it because they were so cash-strapped. They were going to be relegated. The Players Football Association was paying the wages of some of the players. And they were so desperate that the owner, Tony Wood, joked that he'd sell the club to anyone for a fiver. And so they'd given like unlimited access to the club to the people filming it. And Wood eventually did sell the club to Barry Hearn, the boxing and snooker promoter and darts promoter, as he is now. But basically, he'd run out of money because the Rwandan genocide had led to his coffee plantations being razed to the ground. So that his money, Tony Wood's money, had come from coffee right. in Rwanda. And obviously, the human tragedy of the Rwandan genocide was the Civil War. But he losing his money in Rwanda meant the club had no money, so that, he went trying to sell. Yeah, ended up trying to sell it.
That feels like such a butterfly effect.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Rwanda has a civil war, and Leyton Orient Football Club falls to pieces.
Yeah, absolutely. The best bit of the documentary is John Sitton, who was the manager, was giving a half-time team talk. They were 1-0 down to Blackpool, who were then being managed by Sam Allardyce.
Mm-hmm.
He sacked defender Terry Howard during the team talk. And I'll remind you, this is all on film. And offered to fight Barry Lakin and Mark Warren. But I quote to you, and there is some strong language in this, listeners. You little cunt. And you fucking big cunt, when I tell you to do something, do it. We'll have a fucking right sword out in here, and you can bring your fucking dinner, because by the time I'm finished with you, you'll fucking need it. And that line about the dinner is kind of weird. And eventually, I read an interview with this guy more recently, where he said that basically he'd been to see the film Colours, starring Robert Duvall and Sean Penn, and Sean Penn needles Robert Duvall's character so much that Duvall says, you look at me, and you see an old man who's finished. Let's get in the ring tomorrow, and you can bring your lunch.
He didn't even quote it right,
yeah,
then.
He didn't. Yeah, I know, right? Orient only won one of the next 15 games after that match, and the managers were sacked, and they were relegated.
I love a good dressing room meltdown.
On film, all on YouTube, you can go watch it, it's phenomenal.
I just love, I think it's Barry Fry who does it, but when he'll just go in a room just going, you're shit,
yes.
You, you're getting sold in the morning, like, just around everyone.
I went to America for my choices, though. Okay. You sort of alluded to it earlier on. American football owners and this or big sports team owners have a habit of like buying a franchise and then moving it,
mm-hmm.
which is that's like the AFC Wimbledon thing and the MK Dons thing is I can't think off the top of my head of any other club doing it, certainly in recent memory. Whereas it happens seemingly in America all the bloody time. Maybe the most egregious example most recently was that in 2006, Howard Schultz, who was the CEO of Starbucks, sold...
I thought he wrote Peanuts.
Yes. I think you're... Yeah, I think he liked both Peanuts and coffee beans.
Yeah.
he sold the Seattle Supersonics to a group of Oklahoma City investors led by a chap called Clay Bennett. And a year later, Bennett announced that he'd move the entire franchise to Oklahoma City. You and I both read about Marge Schott.
Oh, she is awful.
We just to add a bit of diversity to the group, we have a female club owner here.
It's really refreshing. Barry's about to tell you about this. I said to him before the podcast, it's really refreshing to read about a rich woman who's awful for a change.
Yeah, just for a change. She owned the Cincinnati Reds baseball team from 1984 to 1999. And on the surface, you read some of these things, think, oh, quite nice. She kept the price of a hot dog down to $1.
Delightful.
She kept box seats at around $12, the cheapest in baseball. She sat in a regular box seat herself and would often sign autographs for the crowd. And she had her little dogs with her.
Mm-hmm.
She did let the dogs shit in the outfield on the baseball ground.
Yeah, but that's a forgivable eccentricity.
Yeah, she refused to post scores from other games that were taking place on the scoreboard in the ground because apparently this cost $350 a month and she didn't want to spend the money on it.
Bit skinflinty.
Basically said people should, you know, pay attention to the match happening in front of them. She also refused to hire scouts to go scout for other players because she said all they do is sit around and watch ball games.
I mean, that sounds like Mike Ashley has taken that straight out of her playbook.
Yeah. She was quite insensitive about the death of an umpire who died during a game in their ground. And so to try and make up for it, she sent a bouquet of flowers to his funeral, except they were a bouquet of flowers that had already been given to her. She re-gifted them to this funeral, just sticking a card in them. But the crowning turds on the top of her pile of steaming dog shit is her anti-Semitism and racism. She was involved in a court case with a former marketing director at the club, Cal Levy, who said she used the phrase $1 million N-words to refer to several players at the club and imposed an unwritten rule about not hiring black people.
I mean, it's better than a written rule.
I guess so. Yeah, at least he didn't codify it.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as it's not written in stone above the entrance to the stadium, that is better.
Levy is Jewish. He said that Schott kept a Nazi swastika armband in her home and overheard her say, "Sneaky goddamn Jews are all alike."
All I'm saying is that the sneaky Jews are all alike, but most of us aren't sneaky.
The next day, she issued a statement saying these claims were overstated, she didn't mean to offend anybody, and her ownership of the armband was because it was a gift from a former employee.
And that former employee was Lemmy from Motorhead.
What? Imagine being like an employee of someone going, you know what my boss would really love? Charles Comiskey, he's involved in one of the most famous sporting scandals in America, the Black Sox scandal, where eight players on the Chicago White Sox worked together to throw the 1919 World Series. Initially, Comiskey, he's a former baseball player, he was the son of an Illinois politician, and he was owner of the White Sox from 1900 till 1931, and he helped build up their stadium. They won 5 American League pennants, 2 World Series. However, his sort of attitude to the players was apparently so poor that it helped sort of instill a sense of anger and spite among them, which some people say fed into the Black Sox scandal. He basically was very stingy. He would make them wash their own uniforms after matches. He paid horrendously underpaid them. They made, you know, tiny amounts of money compared to what other players were being paid at the time. He offered a $10,000 bonus to Eddie Kikot if he could win 30 games in a season. And when Kikot was closing in on that number, Charles Comiskey made him, basically benched him so that he couldn't reach the 30 game mark.
To be fair, I've often done that on Football Manager. When a player's been getting close to an appearance bonus or something, I've not played them again.
Apparently, he promised his players a bonus for winning the 1919 American League pennant. The bonus was a case of flat champagne. He's an absolute charmer. But then again, at least he didn't let his dog shit in the outfield.
And I imagine they shat in swastika buttons.
I also read about there's a team called the New York Islanders, a hockey team. We've had a couple of interesting owners. Charles Wang was a guy who owned it. He was a computing magnate. He basically campaigned for a long time to let the local authorities let him build a new arena for the team on Long Island. Spent ages being turned down, said that that experience was a bit of hell, in his words. He later said he wished he'd never bought the team, and as a complete, like, know-nothing about hockey, he showed up and suggested that maybe they should put sumo wrestlers in the goals as goalkeepers.
I would pay to watch that.
Sumo hockey players.
So just still in their sumo, like, outfit?
That is chilly.
Yeah,
that
you're going to have someone's eye out with their nipples.
Yeah. A previous owner of the club was a guy called John Spano or Spano. In October 1996, Spano was apparently the owner of an aircraft leasing business, and he agreed to buy the Islanders from the longtime owner of the club, John Pickett, for $165 million. He said, Spano, that he had started with one company with 4 employees, and he'd built it up to a group of 10 companies, 6,000 employees worldwide in just 6 years. He claimed to be worth $230 million. This is too good to be true, because they had been worried about the future of the Islanders. The NHL commissioner, Gary Bettman, thought he was going to be a lifesaver for them. There was rumours of them maybe moving from New York, and he wanted to keep a team in New York, because I know it's a big market and all of that. He said he was going to keep the team there. He was going to, you know, rebuild or maybe replace the stadium they played in. And he paid for the team with a loan from a syndicate of banks. And the league's owners approved the sale in 1997. And the first payment was of $16.5 million was due to go through. And it wasn't quite there, but Spano said he had a letter from Lloyd's Bank in London. The money would definitely be wired out. So, you know, Pickett said that was fine. He closed the deal. Then a couple months later, the NHL, the Board of Governors met, and Spano wasn't there. Instead, they were represented by a couple of men from the old regime. Apparently, Spano had only paid $26,200 to Pickett. for the cable rights after 5 attempts. On one attempt, he'd wired him only $5,000 instead of the $5 million agreed to be paid on that occasion. On another occasion, he was meant to send $17 million. The check bounced. On another occasion, when he was asked to repay the $17 million, he sent $1,700.
No, this is just a man who doesn't understand how decimal points work.
Yeah, he just kept knocking off zeros off. It's brilliant. It completely, obviously, grossly misrepresented his worth. He was only worth $5 million. His company only had 22 employees, not the 6,000, he said. He said he'd attended a very exclusive school in Ohio, but had actually just been in one in suburban Cleveland. And his inherited wealth, he said he'd received a lot of money from his grandfathers. Never happened. Did the sort of a Stephen Ireland job of inventing some grandparents to give himself some credence. He later did 3 different prison terms. He's currently in the middle of one for 10 years for theft and forgery. And over his lifetime has amassed a combined $12 million in fines.
That's almost as much as Sir Alex Ferguson amassed in fines complaining about referees.
Yeah. But it's time, Ben. We've got a slot for him. I'm going to suggest, as the world's worst sports club owner, Donald Trump. We've not had him on the show yet. And bear in mind, we started releasing episodes of this about 2 weeks before he was inaugurated.
Welcome, Mr. President.
It's
welcome.
About time. Just before he gets impeached, we should get him on.
Yeah.
He owned a club called the New Jersey Generals, a football club.
As in football?
American football.
Right.
American football. And they were part of the USFL. That's the United States Football League. It was conceived by a New Orleans businessman called David Dixon, who saw basically a gap in the market, a summer football league, who would play when the NFL and college football wasn't playing.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, it took 20 years basically nearly for this to get off the ground. But in 1983, the USFL took off and they started as a going concern. And the New Jersey Generals were a team that played at the Giants Stadium. And from very early on, Dixon wanted a team in New York. Again, it's a big market area. And he tapped up Donald Trump and various other people to own a team. Trump backed out after paying the initial installment on the franchise because he wanted to buy the Baltimore Colts in the NFL. Trump basically wanted to be part of the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, Dixon persuaded a guy called J. Walter Duncan to step in. However, Duncan was getting on a bit. He lived in Oklahoma. He was having to fly over and back see his team play. So after a year in charge of the team, he put it up to sale. And Trump said, okay, I'll buy the club, buy the team.
Hugely talented businessman. He knows what he's doing. His expertise will be welcomed.
Immediately tried to hire as their manager and their coach, Don Shula. Now, Don Shula, it's like the MK Dons appearing.
Yep.
And going, Alex Ferguson, come manage us at the height of his power. Like in 1999, going, Alex Ferguson, you want to come manage us? Because Don Shula was like the coach of the Miami Dolphins. He'd led them to 2 Super Bowls. He'd led them in the only perfect NFL season ever. Like a complete no losses, mm-hmm. all victories game. He currently, still as a coach, has the most career wins as an NFL coach.
Listen, Trump just wants the best guy.
Yeah, well, he didn't get him. You'll be glad to know they got to the playoffs in both 1984 and 1985. They lost in both the first round of the playoffs. But basically, from the moment Trump took over the Generals, he was going to try and use them as a way to get into the NFL. He began pushing the other USFL owners to move them from the summer to the fall to basically program them directly opposite the NFL. He was going to try and move the Generals over to New York City, have them play at Shea Stadium until they built a new 80,000-seater Trump Stadium in Manhattan.
Oh, just imagine if that exists now, the fucking horrendous rallies in that place.
Oh, God. And basically, the idea was they'd move them opposite the NFL, and then they would bring an antitrust court case against the NFL saying that the NFL were monopolizing the broadcast of football. And they were going to use that as a way to bring down the NFL, or in Trump's mind, force a merger that would see, you know, USFL clubs get to join the NFL and double the investment of the owners and increase their prestige and everyone end up happy.
So this is Donald Trump trying to use monopoly laws as the underdog.
Yes, he very much saw himself as the underdog in this. But again, it's also using a team which had at this point a bit of a following,
mm-hmm.
and a league which had been the dream of this guy Dixon for 20 years as a way for him to get an NFL team.
That seems very uncharacteristic.
Yeah, I know. They decided to push forward this case. Trump sort of led it, and he was absolutely certain they were going to win. They were going to get the merger. The whole thing was going to happen. NFL's lawyer, Frank Rothman, and I quote, said, Trump was such a lousy witness for them and a great one for us. It was at the height of his 80s smarm, mm-hmm. and literally everybody fucking hated him.
Great.
And the NFL used him as the figurehead of the USFL case to go, this is the guy we're fighting against. So even though the USFL were the newcomers and the underdogs, the NFL managed to present Trump as one of America's richest men as a complete jackass and like so, the person you love to hate, and turned the entire jury against him. During this came out in the court case, Trump had met the NFL commissioner at the Pierre Hotel in New York. Trump said that the commissioner had said in this meeting, you'll have a good chance of an NFL franchise. You will have an NFL franchise. The trade-off would be that they'd keep the USFL in the spring and not bring a lawsuit. And Trump was basically like, see, this is them trying to stop any competition. Rozelle, the commissioner of the NFL, was a meticulous note keeper, mm-hmm. and noted the meeting he'd had with Trump and quoted Trump saying, I want an NFL expansion team in New York. I would get some stiff to buy the New York Generals, my team in the USFL. A juror, Patricia Sibilia, said he did not do the USFL well. Donald Trump and I actually got into a staring match. I would watch the people on the stand trying to read them. So he and I started looking at each other and he tried to stare me down. It was an obvious try at intimidation. This is a member of the jury he's got to try to get on side.
Is it? This sounds like Trump doesn't understand how courts work.
Yeah, I mean, evidently doesn't. Rothman, again, the NFL's lawyer, asked over and over again what motivated Trump, and he showed Trump loads of documents signed or written by him that alluded to a merger and a merger strategy, completely undermining his case that this was an antitrust thing. Trump denied that was his motive, but obviously people could see that was all it was all about. That was Sibilia's words, no question. Rothman suggested his ultimate goal was to end up working with the NFL to increase his own value. And he said, no, this is total Trump. I could have gotten into the NFL a lot easier than going through this exercise. I could have spent the extra money and bought the Baltimore Colts on many occasions. The article I read about this said there was some epic eye-rolling in the court. Trump obviously lying. No one had considered him a serious candidate. The USFL won this court case. The uh-huh. NFL were found guilty, but the judge only ordered a nominal payout of $1.
And that is the dollar that made Donald Trump a billionaire.
Yeah. When he announced it as $1, John Mara was in the room. He was the son of the New York Giants owner, Wellington Mara. He pulled out a $1 bill from his wallet and handed it to Donald Trump.
Oh, that's incredible.
Our candidates for the world's worst sports club owner are Ben's suggestion of the 53,000 people who signed up to own Ebbsfleet United in 2007, courtesy of myfootballclub.com. Johnny's suggestion of racehorse owner and wannabe arsonist Ken Richardson. And my suggestion of America's 45th president, Donald J. Trump. I love a good, you know, put Trump up there, but I feel like we've got a bigger slot for him to fill somewhere down the line.
I mean, we've got World's Worst Tycoon scheduled for December.
This is true. Maybe we'll come back to this then. And you know what? He'd just see it as an honour.
Yeah.
We're not going to give him that pleasure. There are the jury's out on this one, if not on other things he's done.
The jury's out on it, and he is trying to stare them down and intimidate them.
I love the Ken Richardson story so much. I read it as well. I just think he's such a complete arsehole. But I had never heard of myfootballclub.com, Ben. One football club owner managed, on their own is like a nightmare. Imagining 53,000 Donald Trumps and Ken Richardsons.
Well, I think a mixture of there'll be that and also 53,000 keyboard warriors.
Yes.
Can I just say, we can't be 100% sure if Donald Trump and Ken Richardson weren't some of the 53,000 people that tried to buy into Bad Sweet.
That's a very good point. So actually, by picking my football club... .com. Are they .com? They sound like a .biz. Yeah. My football club and the 53,000, we're kind of picking all football club owners.
Yes.
So congratulations, Ben, and Ebbsfleet United. We'll be keeping an eye out for you on your way up through the leagues. Before we go, I've got to give you the world's worst news of the week. This news comes that the end of the world is on its way, guys. Not in the way you thought. No,
there's a Nibiru back.
No, there's a different asteroid. There's an asteroid called Apophis, which is due to strike Earth. Well, I say strike Earth. According to one guy, a research scientist, Michael Horn, he's pretty sure that this asteroid, otherwise known as the God of Chaos, is going to hit somewhere on Earth very specific. That somewhere very specific is somewhere between the North Sea and the Black Sea. Which isn't that specific.
So Europe.
Yeah, Europe, basically.
That's like Ryanair giving out where they're going to land.
100%. Apparently, it's going to pass by Earth in 2029. This is a very large asteroid. But it's not going to get much closer, apparently, than about 19,000 miles. It measures...
That is quite close.
It's quite close. It measures 340 metres across. I reckon we'll be able to see it. Elon Musk has offered his opinion on the matter. He shared an article from The Express in Britain about the asteroid and said...
This asteroid's a paedophile?
Yeah. he said, Apophis, great name. Wouldn't worry about this particular one, but a big rock will hit Earth eventually, and we currently have no defence. Before we go, Johnny, where can people find out more about you and your work and anything else?
They can follow me on Twitter at Johnny Gabriel, and the men's mental health charity that I'm an ambassador for is at The Calm Zone, and they're doing amazing work around mental health and men's suicide prevention and things like that.
That's grand. You're doing stuff with a bunch of comedians. I know you're working with Lauren Patterson and Darren Harriott, I think, on a couple of things. Is that right?
So Calm have a podcast called Conversations Against Living Miserably, and they do that's released every Wednesday with a different comedian discussing how they remain calm, giving general tips and things like that.
Wow, excellent. Well, tune into that once you finish listening to this, which is about to happen right now. We're all off to burn down the Worsford Ford studios and try and cash in the insurance money. Thank you for listening to Worsford Ford. Goodbye.
The job is done.
Ben, we're still inside it.
Oh, shit. We've become the meme of the dog with the paint gun. This is fine.
This is fine. This is fine.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.